Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady, and when I'm not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. So I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brands, startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. First off, we join Chef Carrie Heffernan at the Green Market for some super sweet bay scallops. The season opened on Monday of this week, and Carrie was the founding executive chef of 11 Madison Park. He also created the Shack Burger and now does advocacy work for the seas and is writing a book on sustainable seafood. And then in just a few minutes, we'll welcome here in the studio with me, chef partner John Fraser of Dovetail in the Upper West Side and Narcisa in the Standard Hotel East Village. When he's not running uptown and downtown between his two spots, he is practicing a Thai martial art called Muay Thai, and running marathons. And we'll talk veggies and what it was like to work at the French Laundry at the time when Grant Achatz and Rene Redzepi were also there. Stay to the end, because to wind it down, we'll talk with sommelier Davis Anderson of New York Sushi Co. on why you need to prepare your winter wine bunker. So let's go to the Green Market. Here at the Union Square Green Market with Carrie Heffernan.
Good morning. How are you, lady?
Good. How are you?
Great. Very excited.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm especially excited because I feel like I just got sushi at like 10 a.m. this morning because one of those little bay scallops, like, you know, escaped from the bag and said, eat me, eat me.
A lucky little pearl.
So those were delicious.
They're amazing. We're so lucky. They just opened the season on Monday, November 3rd. Stephanie's got them today on Wednesday. It's apparently going to be a very good season, and you can tell that by a couple of things. The size of the scallops is large. The price is pretty reasonable. She's selling for $21.95, but of course, at $10.15, she's already sold out.
Wow.
So come here early if you want them.
Mm.
And they'll be making their way into local markets soon, so
mm-hmm.
it's not as if you can only get them here.
Mm-hmm.
But these are local Peconic Bay scallops as opposed to Nantucket.
Okay.
Each of them have a slightly different characteristic. Same animal, different things that they eat,
mm-hmm.
different water temperatures, different environments. They taste different. I love these. They're not quite as like candy sweet
yep.
as the Nantuckets, but they're briny and luscious and soft and unctuous. And I just think that, you know, you had it. You
I
can
think
tell
they,
us.
They appear a little bigger than Nantucket Bay ones.
You can get... Both bay scallops might be small or large, depending
okay.
on... And what happens, in my experience, is you get the larger ones in the beginning part of the season.
Oh.
Because the guys who scallop pretty much know where they're going to be. So opening day comes, they go right to these, like, beds and
right.
scoop them up.
The low-hanging
like,
fruit.
The low-hanging fruit, quite literally. And then they're shucking them is an enormous amount of work. So they're probably going to just shuck the big ones first. And then as the season goes on, as they have less fish to work with, and this is, you know, one of their only resources, they'll spend time to get the smaller ones and shuck them. That's my experience.
Oh, okay. So when you, what is the shucking? Is it similar to shucking an oyster? How does it even look?
So it's that scallop shell, just like it's on the logo of
yeah.
Shell Oil.
Yep, yep.
It's exactly that. And you go in with a short, rounded knife, and you cut one part of the adductor muscle. So the entire scallop is one muscle of the animal.
Mm.
Around that will be the belly, the eyes, You know, sometimes you'll see a little liver, eggs, but basically you're going to just go in one shot top, one shot bottom, and hopefully liberate the muscle from the belly, which is the hard part. So you do that cleanly, and, you know, you're going to have this amazing product. I save the eyes and sometimes the stomachs to make, like, little stocks and sauces with.
Yeah.
The eyes are kind of a delicacy, but they're very firm. It's like that fluke fin. So it's not something that most Americans like to eat raw.
Yep.
I do. But you could fry them up and do other things with them.
I think I need to hang out with you more.
Well, you've got to come scalloping. That's the fun part.
Okay.
So if you get the right day, so there's like the recreational scalloping, which is what I do in the commercial. The commercial guys put big dredges out. They scoop the bottom. They pull it all up. They sort from the spider crabs and other stuff they get into, you know, these very valuable bay scallops.
Mm-hmm.
What I do is go out in, at low tide in shallow water with hopefully a calm day and good overhead light, you know, bright sunny day. And you can literally look for them and then just take a net and scoop them up. That's one way to do it. Some people put waders on and get these big glass boxes called look boxes so they can see below the surface of the water and you can see them and scoop them up that way. So again, the beginning of the season, everyone's got their way of getting them.
Yep.
And it's kind of like this bonanza. It's like that scene in Jaws where all those boats in that flotilla are leaving the harbor. As the season progresses and there's less and less scallops and there's less and less interest and the weather gets worse and worse, it gets down to more of your serious commercial guys.
So when is the end of the season again?
I think the season probably runs until as late as April, I think. It's certainly March.
Awesome.
But the amount of scallops you can get, the weather, it's less and less productive to go out and do it.
So talk to me about the sustainability of bay scallops.
So bay scallops are a perfect example because they speak to the health of the water. In other words, you need a certain amount of clear water. You need eelgrass beds for them to live in, and that says something about the quality of the water. The other thing is they're only a two-year life cycle. So first year is unharvestable. You got to put those back.
Mm-hmm.
But a second-year scallop, which is what we get here, if you don't harvest it and eat it, they will simply die. That's their life cycle.
Mm, so that would be a shame.
That would be a shame to have the crabs get them. So it's very short life cycle. Great barometer of the quality of the water and a great local sustainable seafood.
How are we cooking them at home?
Right. If you're going to cook them, and I would recommend eating them raw to start.
Yeah, just
so
like I did
amazing,
right now. Oh, my
exactly
God.
Exactly as you did.
Popcorn.
You might want to cut them in half. I mean, it's a popping them. They're a little large to eat a lot that way. One or two is kind of fun. But as a dish, what I would do is cut them, and I would just put a little salt, maybe a touch of acid, you know, perhaps. You know, they're getting these fresh kaffir limes and fresh yuzu I've seen in the market from California. Would be kind of a nice, you know, different addition to it. Maybe a tiny bit of chive or tarragon. I wouldn't do an awful lot in overwhelming the flavor because they're so amazing.
Yeah.
You can cook them. What I would suggest is like a super hot pan. Dry them very well. Season really well with salt and pepper. Screamed in the pan. They'll jump around. I kind of do them sort of half raw, just hot.
Yeah.
You don't want to cook them too much.
Yeah.
So it's no more than a minute or 90 seconds. So any day now we're going to have a frost, a serious frost. It's going to sweeten the squashes. What I would do is roast some squash. Put the seared scallops with it, maybe a touch of that lovely pumpkin seed oil, and then a tiny bit of an acid complement, you know, maybe deglaze the pan with some red wine vinegar, a touch of thyme, and you're done.
That sounds delicious. Put it over some rice, call it more innovative chirashi.
A few greens and you're done.
Yum. Okay, complete meal in one bowl. Well, thank you so much, Carrie.
My pleasure. Love to talk local and anything seafood with you, lady.
That was Carrie Heffernan, first ever chef of 11 Madison Park, fisherman and seafood expert and advocate. And you could get those scallops at the Blue Moon Fishery Stand. Thank you, Stephanie Villani. So welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on Heritage Radio Network. If you love what you hear, please do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Leyte Su, that's L-E-I-T-I-H-S-U, me, at Heritage underscore Radio, and hashtag WOMSHO, that's short for Word of Mouth, W-O-M-S-H-O-W. And with that, I am so pleased to welcome today people we like. Chef partner John Fraser of Dovetail in the Upper West Side. And you may remember very briefly What Happens When, the very unusual pop-up restaurant, and Narcissa in the Standard Hotel East Village. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
It's really a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
Because I went to Dovetail many, many years ago, and then I don't go to the Upper West Side a whole lot, so I need to make a return, because apparently it's changed. And What Happens When was zany.
It was short, thank God.
So, and congratulations on Narcissa.
Thank you.
So New York Marathon was just this weekend. You've run some marathons in your day, right?
I have, yeah. Those days are a little bit behind me, though. Four of them. Two New York, one LA, and one Twin Cities. That's Minnesota, St. Paul.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, and at what point did you decide that your marathoning career was over?
When I hit my time. So going in, I said, you know, I want to run a 3:30, and it took me four times to get there. So,
wow.
And after that, I just said, that's it. I mean, you know, the sort of wear and tear on the old knees after a while of, you know, the everyday on your feet in the kitchen, and sort of, I run kind of like a donkey.
So,
really? So yeah, it's a very heavy footed situation. So I decided to sort of hang up the sneakers. I did go and watch the marathon. I do every year. It's New York City like you've never seen. If you've never run it, I mean, and you've got, you know, 6 or 8 hours on your hands, and you maybe can walk it.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. And New York City comes out, you know, like I said, I did a couple of, others besides New York City, mm-hmm. New Yorkers come out and cheer. Like, I mean, you do feel like you're an Olympian for a day. It's
oh
pretty
my
incredible.
Gosh.
Yeah.
So wait, some people actually walk the whole thing?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps, I mean, I think that everybody at some point probably walks a piece of the marathon, but, you know, if you've got a little bit of gas in the tank, I would recommend it highly. It's a pretty incredible experience, and it seems like a lot of people get to experience. I think it's like 50,000 people run it or something insane,
yeah,
like that, but it really is life changing, and it makes you see New York in a different way. And see New Yorkers in a different way as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you go onto the subway and you're getting, you know, your ass grabbed and smacked around, and you're like, I hate New York. And then, you know, you go and you run a marathon, and it sort of, you know, adjusts your view of humanity a little bit. Everyone's sort of like excited, and you're a total stranger, and they're yelling for you, and it's just like, wow, you know, people are okay here, actually. You know?
I was asking about the walking because I was just thinking about options for myself.
Yeah.
Marathon running is just not my forte.
Yeah.
So I was just, you know, I want to do it too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many other, I mean, there's other races and there's other sort of, you know, distances, so to speak. But there's something about that day in New York City that's pretty
what
special.
What is like what's the part where like it gets really rough, like for you?
Every marathon was different for me.
Yeah.
You know, I think it for me it was that like moment before start, or the half hour, so to speak, where you've just got like jitters and you're sort of, they call them corrals, actually, you're corralled with the time that you believe you'll finish. So let's say I said 3:30, so mm-hmm. I was corralled with a bunch of people who said they would run 3:30,
mm-hmm.
and you're just sort of like looking around like what's about to happen. It feels like sort of animals to slaughter.
Ugh.
And then you run through a finish line, and then you're just like, okay, just be careful not to trip and fall down, number
yeah.
one, over on a bridge.
Yep.
And number two, be careful not to come out too fast, because, you know, to sort of get the adrenaline pumping, you start running, and pretty
yeah.
soon, you know, 3 hours later, you're like, why did I run a 7-minute mile on the first one? That was dumb.
Oh, got it. Wow.
So, you know, it's the fastest way to lose 10 pounds as well, just so you know.
Okay. All right. And you seem pretty slim and trim. You're also yeah. running back and forth between the East Village and the Upper West Side, which
yeah.
isn't the easiest commute in
it's
New
not,
York.
It's not. It's not. But it's you know, luckily I have super, super strong teams at both
mm-hmm.
Places. So I'm sort of, in a way, I'm in the way when I'm there. So they kind of don't need me that much, and kind of.
So you might as well go on vacation
exactly,
to the Caribbean
exactly.
right now.
Phone it in over a daiquiri. Squash season. Put it on.
Davide Scavin, a recent guest, said that his dream job was to be a computer hacker because it requires creativity and he could do it from the beach.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you also do Muay Thai.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's Thai kickboxing. It's, I mean, it's as much, I don't know how to describe it, but I mean, there's certainly a lot of contact there and there's a lot of, sort of aggression and it's more like a sprint and less like a marathon, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also something about the sort of physical contact and that kind of, the Napoleonic thing inside of me gets to be, stricken for the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in kitchens and they're hot and sort of annoying and there's so many reasons to sort of, outburst and that solved it for me. That was the one thing that sort of got me, into a place of calmness and Buddhist state, you know?
Are you one of those people that is like you, cause you seem pretty low key, like mm-hmm. you're just sort of humming along mm-hmm. and you don't talk very loudly. Mm-hmm. And then are you one of those people that's quiet, 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 and suddenly you blow up?
Probably, yeah. I probably can't see myself in those moments, so that's probably the case, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
I sort of let it build up until it explodes, right?
Noted. So why did you choose Muay Thai of all the martial arts?
You know, when I was a kid, I used to do, karate and... like stuff like that, and it was interesting, but I didn't really have the mind for it, and there was no contact in that thing I was doing, and I was sort of looking for something else after marathons to get into, and I'm a bit of an obsessive, so you know, sort of like when I decide to do something, I want to go all the way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed like the right thing, so I went to a free session and it felt pretty good, and then I got punched in the face a couple times and I was like, ooh, this is gonna work for me, you know, and it's therapeutic in a way, you know.
Really?
Yeah, and it's an individual sport, and we talked about this the other evening. It's an individual sport, so it's, you know, in you know, restaurants and cooking and everything, that's a team sport, right? You're constantly sort of, your weakest link is your lowest point,
yep.
and your strongest, you know, and you're constantly, I'm more of a coach than I guess a team member
mm-hmm.
now, but it's truly individual. It's you and one other person. And in that way, it's sort of freeing, you know, you're not relying on others or,
that's
you know,
awesome.
Sort of you can look inside and stay with yourself.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because
more therapy.
Yes, because chefs need therapy.
Mm. On Thursdays, 3:15.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for sure. It's what gets me. It's what got me here. You know, before I started down that journey, there's no way I could be sitting in front of a microphone. There's no way.
Really?
Oh no.
Because you were super
shy and introverted, and yeah, a bit of a basket case.
Okay, yeah, I see like glimmers of that in you.
Thanks.
But you seem really like, you seem really amiable now.
Yeah, I guess you can, yeah.
I've been considering, you know, you actually using my insurance sometimes and going to therapy.
Right.
Just because, I don't know, sometimes it's nice to have someone put like...
The question is why not, you know? I mean, if you have an extra hour and you have a couple bucks, I think that the American style is to work on the outside, you know, so everyone's in the gym and they've, you know, they're doing whatever to make the outside be well,
mm-hmm.
but the inside sort of goes neglected. And neglecting is probably around the word, but
forgotten
or sort of pushed aside because it's not that fun, and you sort of do get into some stuff that maybe you don't want to encounter again or what have you.
Yep.
But there's something about it that's it does, I say the word journey, it really is. I mean, because where you start is not where you plan to land, and you find yourself in places personally that make a lot of sense.
Well, it takes a little bravery to sign up for, you know, not like we all have just a spare hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a little bit of initiative
right.
and bravery to sign
right.
up. So what was that point where you're like, you know, I would really like to try this?
I don't know. I think it was, you know, when I saw the things that I couldn't do because, you know, when I just realized that I needed help, I guess it sounds like I'm on a 12 step or something, but I think that was when I heard that others were in it, people that I respected. I think that as a young guy, a young lad, you think about therapy as associated with weakness
mm-hmm.
or something horrible happening.
Yeah.
But I think of it more as a mechanic, you know, keeping the car running, keeping it smooth.
That's very manly of you.
Yeah. Well, you know, picking out the tool chest.
Speaking of people that you look up to, you had the tremendous opportunity of, you worked at the French Laundry mm-hmm. for a couple of years with Thomas Keller and also other greats who ended up becoming greats later on.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was great. So, you know, it was really the bullseye moment for me in my career. You know, I'd finished college and I decided I would try this thing called cooking. Back then it didn't look the way it does now. In other words, there was no kind of roadmap. I say it like back then, but it was, you know, 15 years ago or something like that. it didn't look quite the same. And I had a chance to go and work at the French Laundry for a couple of days. And I kind of, convinced Thomas to give me a job, even though I wasn't necessarily as qualified as the others around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I landed in a spot that was right next to him basically all day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in addition to that, there were some really super talented people in that kitchen. And there are always talented people in the kitchen, but they've gone on to do things so you can sort of reminisce. But, you know, Grant Achatz, Rene Redzepi, Eric Siebold, Brandon Sharp, Lachlan Patterson, and many others. And you know, sort of my commis at the time then went on to be the chef de cuisine, my partner, Corey Lee from Bennu. We worked next to each other for over a year. So at the time, it was a pretty important place to be, but you never know that until after the fact. And we were all kind of, we were animals. I mean, we were climbing all over each other for creativity and ingredients and busting each other's chops. And what came of it was a lot of really good cooks.
Isn't it lovely reading about friends in the news?
Yeah.
There's actually an app for that. It's called Newsla. Or Newsly, Newsle.
Uh-huh.
It's awesome. Like, you get an email with a roundup of your friends in the news.
Oh,
and
that's,
you know, if we, you know, you have friends who are talented and I have friends who are talented.
Right.
It's like,
I don't want to know how good my friends are doing.
Oh,
I don't
want
to know. No, I don't want to know. It creates competition. Then I'm going to go find myself at their restaurant. No.
So you guys went out, what, drinking? Like, you know,
yeah,
beers,
well,
blah,
you know,
blah,
the,
blah.
I mean, we used to bust our ass. It mm-hmm. was, my days were really long. I had the rule for myself, while working there, no drinking on school nights. So I would not go out after work. I mean, it was really like, I would go in really early because it took me a while to get into the motion of what was supposed to be happening. I was super competitive, but I would be in there very early and we'd get out really late, 2 in the morning sort of situation. So, there was a couple bars that we did go out to, you know, in town. One is Ponches, I think one was called. Oh, it's pretty good. Anyway, but the weekends were sort of the time that we were able to run around.
Mm-hmm. And when you say weekends, your weekends.
Our 2 days off, right?
Yep.
So and the lack of single females in Yountville.
Really?
And the lack of resources, you know, we're poor cooks. You know, it really drove us to sort of take travels. So we were in Berkeley and San Francisco and Sonoma, Calistoga.
Wow.
So we're constantly kind of looking for something to do. You know, it's sort of a small town mentality.
Sounds
and especially
like trouble.
Yeah, I know. And you sort of, your ego is in a place where you're like, I'm at the best restaurant in the country. And then, you know, on your day off, you're like, well, okay, I have no money and I have no resources and there's nothing really to do. So what are we going to do? So there was a lot of kind of road trippy stuff happening there.
Grant Achatz and Rene Redzepi, they were like kids back then.
Yeah,
I mean, you were a kid too, but I think, aren't you?
Was a kid.
You were a kid.
Thank you.
And you look like a kid.
Okay, thanks.
What were they like as, you know, kids in the kitchen? Like, let's forget what, you know, that they
right.
all have your own restaurants.
So Rene
now.
was on a bit of a walkabout. I would have to remind myself, it's been a long time,
yep.
but he was on a bit of a walkabout. I think that he was coming from El Bulli and he stayed at the French Laundry for a number of months.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't on a station or anything like that. He was sort of more kind of jumping in and helping out. We had these, they're called stagiaire, and they kind of stay off to the side.
Right.
I mean, he clearly was talented and came through the European system and had chops, but it wasn't quite as on show.
Yeah.
You know, not being in service, so to
mm-hmm.
speak. Very funny guy, great sense of humor, and he really, you know, he busted his ass as well. Grant at that time was a sous chef, and we had a lot of fun. Grant and I, we used to sort of get in these little wars, and you know, Grant is a really, really intelligent and thoughtful cook, but at the time he was coming back from El Bulli, and maybe they might have actually met there, he and Rene, and that sort of happened.
Mm-hmm.
That may be how he arrived. But, you know, Grant was coming back with a box full of gelatin and agar agar. And at the time, we weren't really doing things like that at the French Laundry. We were doing some glazes and some gelée, but Grant had a whole box full of tricks. And we really saw the beginning of something else in the French Laundry kitchen. And so there was a lot of sort of, you know... at the time I would always say things like, you know, Thomas Keller wants to stack everything out and Grant wants to spread it all out on the plate. So there was always this sort of laughing like, oh, there's a Grant dish, you know, but it, all in good fun. And I think there was a lot of, we pushed each other very, very hard. And I think that's part of the thing that I try and instill in my kitchens as well. I mean, I can't be there for every moment of every day to get in people's heads. And the way that you develop a good brigade is when they start to police one another and where they really start to getting into each other's stuff. And when you develop little mentorships as well. I mean, I certainly felt that Grant and I had a kinship, and Eric Siebold, who was the chef de cuisine at the time, had a great kinship, and Thomas, who was at the time didn't have per se, so he was in the kitchen, you know, 5 days a week, and was really part of the brigade.
Amazing.
It was amazing, and he's a fantastic cook. Not only chef, which makes it really easy to go to work every day.
So speaking of your kitchen, I had such a delicious time the other night and learned that I guess you can just stick anything in puff pastry and call it a Wellington.
That's it. Yeah. That's the rule.
Carrots Wellington. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to remember you for if and when someday I have kids who would end up not loving vegetables, and then I will spank them and also send them to you. And you can force feed them carrots.
Right.
So what's it like having an incredible farm attached to your restaurant?
So that was really the selling point for me. Not that I needed one, but you know, I haven't done that many projects in New York City. I'm not in such a rush to expand. And I really, like I said, I'm a bit of obsessive and sort of want everything to be the right way. And I was approached by Andre to do a restaurant inside of the hotel. You know, that hotel had seen a few restaurants in it, and it seemed like slightly risky in a funny neighborhood at the time.
Mm-hmm.
This is going back, you know, almost 3 years ago that we started to talk about it.
It's funny that you would call the Bowery in the East Village right there a funny neighborhood
at the time.
Yes,
yeah.
I know.
Well, at the time. And also, you know, frankly, I wasn't very well traveled downtown. I spent most of my time in New York City in the kitchen. So I didn't know much about, I mean, I knew the standard, the brand very well. I actually opened the standard in Hollywood. I don't know how many years ago. That was before the French Laundry, actually. So that's like 15 or 16 years ago.
Oh, wow. You mean, wow.
Yeah. So I helped open it. Yeah. I helped open it. So I know what the brand is. And I know Andre's, I mean, he's a genius in design and in really being a guest advocate. I mean, he knows sort of how to look ahead and figure out what people want before they want it. And it's fascinating to watch him work. So sorry, I'm babbling on a bit.
No.
But the one thing, so it's a restaurant inside of a hotel, and, and I was, you know, I was sort of promised the sort of proprietary means around the restaurant, meaning it's mine really. It's owned by the hotel, but in terms of the way it runs and the style of the food and everything else, it really is. It's more John Fraser than the standard, so to speak.
Yeah, no, I noticed that when they plugged you in there, I was like, okay, he's more not rustic, but just more vegetable. You know,
yeah,
that kind of sexy, not the standard kind of sexy, which is like models and bottles.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, you might be a models and bottles kind of guy. I don't know.
I'm not sure what that means exactly.
But, you know, I love that they welcomed you into the space to really do what is truly your food.
Right. So, and I think that what they had is this resource is called the farm. And I think the farm is it's used quite well on the west side, but it didn't come into the picture until a few years after the grill opened, the standard grill in the standard west side.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like a different style of food, and they do quite a bit more covers there. So it's very difficult for them to sort of shift gears the way that we can. We're slightly smaller.
Yep.
So yeah, that was really the thing. And I met the farmers, and I went to the farm, and I said, okay, this feels good. This feels like the right move, and it feels like a natural time to do it.
And and in the process you got to know Andre Balas. What's it like working with him?
It's fascinating. So, as I said, I mean, he comes from a place in design and in development that I've never seen before. Mm. So educational is one part of it, but it's also super collaborative. And I think that, you know, from the outside, it's models and bottles. But, mm-hmm. you know, when we get around a table with drawings, I mean, it's getting down to business. And it really is about the guest interaction with the space, guest interaction with the public spaces. You know, how can we make it an unforgettable moment rather than just one that you have?
Yep.
And you see that all around the hotel, you know, whether it's the garden or and really a true investment in the property. I mean, I think that the failure of the previous restaurants, forgive me for saying this, because I like Scott Conan a lot, was that there was a bit of a wallpaper job done and what Andre was able to do was get the money together to truly transform the space into what it always wanted to be.
It is really gorgeous.
Thank you.
Even though I can never find the actual restaurant, I'm always like wandering around in those hallways, and then.
Well, you know that's one of the things that they really want you to do is wander in their properties,
that's cool.
And because it allows you to bump into people and kind of to have interaction with people and
an
have
Alice in Wonderland
a
kind
little
of
bit
feeling.
Rabbit hole feeling. Exactly.
Oh, like the stairs down to the bathroom. Exactly. My goodness, please don't drink too much. You might you might crash into the mirror that's reflecting yourself, and it's just like a dream. And then there's a photo booth.
Fun house.
Where are you from?
I'm from California, Southern.
Same as myself.
Yeah.
Yes. What city?
It's called Yucaipa. Is it a city? Yeah, it's a city now. It was a town when I was growing up there.
Okay.
It's just outside of San Bernardino and sort of LA. We used to surf in the summertime and ski in the wintertime. It's a pretty cool place to grow up. Very, very small, but. Notwithstanding, couldn't wait to get out the moment I could.
What was your like high school stereotype?
What do you mean by that?
Like, were you like a jock, a newspaper guy, a nerd? Were you like a loser?
I still am a loser. I don't think that I had one. I sort of roamed in between. I did play sports, and I was a bit of a nerd. I still am.
Okay.
With pride. But yeah, I didn't really have I didn't fit in so clearly with one group or another.
Really? Yeah. Is that really true?
Yeah.
Okay. Because me too, but that sometimes can be like a...
Ask the one friend I had in high school.
Right. Like sometimes be a little bit of a cop-out answer.
Yeah.
All right. You're versatile. Okay. Speaking of versatility, everyone knows you as the vegetable whisperer. Mm. Do you think that's like, you know, are you cool with being, you know, being called the chef who does vegetables really, 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 really creatively and well, you know, or is that accurate?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what others say, but I can tell you that it's you know, about 5 years ago, I started to think about, you know, cooking food that I would really want to eat. Mm-hmm. And that is vegetables. That's what I subside on for the most part. It's how I want to eat. I eat for fuel and for health.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided I wanted to start to cook that way, and had a chance on Monday nights at Dovetail, which weren't very busy, and we were just sort of like, oh, we can either take the summer off on Mondays or we can come up with an idea, and the idea was vegetables. And that kind of grew into something else. The way that I cook vegetables now is different than when I started.
Okay.
I started with, how can I make a vegetable taste like something else? How can I make a parsnip taste like a piece of meat?
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm a little bit more obsessed with, how can I get the best parsnip and make it taste like the best parsnip?
Perfectly parsnip.
Yeah. So that's that ethic and mission has changed quite a bit over the years. And it's not to say that I don't, you know, value a rotisserie duck done perfectly and served hot with tons of spices and honey on top. It's just to say that that to me feels a little bit easier than the difficulty of the perfect parsnip and how to make a parsnip, you know, truly craveable without the duck fat all over it.
And congratulations on your almost 7-year anniversary of Dovetail.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
seems like
amazing.
Yesterday.
You've gotten to the, it's getting on in restaurant years.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. So how has Dovetail changed since, you know, the beginning to now?
Right. Where to start? I mean, I opened Dovetail as perhaps prematurely as a chef.
Okay.
I had been running around New York City. I'd been a chef of a few places, and I certainly had the chops in terms of training, and I'd worked in some great kitchens. But I wouldn't necessarily say that I was a fully formed creative at the time. I had some good ideas that I put on plates.
Mm-hmm.
I had an idea of the kind of organization that I wanted to run, meaning, you know, I didn't want the excessive of a 40 cheese cart or a bottle, a 2,000 bottle wine list. I really wanted to sort of keep it super simple and super streamlined and focused on what I thought at the moment was very good. As a physical space, we were 65 seats and pretty small, and they weren't all great seats, to be honest. You're sort of sitting next to a brick wall. I'm not positive we deserved the accolades and the things that we got at the time.
New York Times 3 stars.
Yeah. I believe that Frank Bruni had a 3-star meal, but mm-hmm. I don't believe that we consistently delivered a 3-star product.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't meant to be a 3-star restaurant in the first place, to put it that way. But I believe that accolade and I grew into it, and we've been sort of nonstop, you know, how can we get better and how can we expand our program and how can we truly fall into the realm of what we believe a 3-star restaurant is. I'm not saying Bruni was wrong, but I am saying that we couldn't deliver it consistently to every guest
right.
who came
so
through
you
the
just,
door.
You just,
and so I now think we do. I now think that we are
tightened up your game.
Yeah, and we continue to push. I mean, I think that there's still some room on the horizon to get better.
Do you still do that utterly affordable $30-some yep. Sunday supper?
Sunday supper, yeah.
Oh,
so
man.
It's not 30-something anymore. But
wow.
that was in 2007.
Yeah.
Right. There's inflation. Yeah, and you know, that started. I started that from day one.
Wait, how much is it now, though?
It's 48.
Okay.
Yeah. So I started that day one, and the goal was to deliver something to the neighborhood. You know, I said all along that I wanted to open an Upper West Side neighborhood restaurant, and then I started looking at the prices on the menu at the time, and I started to look at the kind of service, and I said this is anything but a neighborhood restaurant as one would think. And I just felt like it would be compelling to do something that was sort of easy, give the restaurant and the cooks a break. It's a prefix menu, it's cheapish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's accessible and accessible to on a cook's wage, accessible, you know, on a prep cook's wage, that they could actually experience what it feels like to be inside of a 3-star New York City fine dining restaurant, but not get shelled
yeah.
and not feel the pressure of spending a lot of money. And that to this day stays sort of grounded. So that Monday has become a bit of a test case for us in terms of dishes where mm-hmm. we sort of play.
Frankly, I like family, like when restaurants do family
yeah.
meal well,
yeah.
that is what I really want to eat,
yeah.
truly.
Yeah, especially on a Sunday, there's something comforting.
Ugh,
you know?
It's
feels
perfect.
Right.
So I would like to ask you how What Happens When happened. I loved that. I went 2 times, 2 different installments of
right.
this restaurant that mm-hmm. changes monthly.
Right.
How'd you come up with it?
So I was on a walkabout looking for maybe a vegetable restaurant, and you know, was with a real estate broker, and we were kind of running around the city, and I happened upon what was then called Le Jardin Bistro, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the restaurant itself was just in terrible shape, and there was a beautiful backyard, and I said, this is it. This is my vegetable restaurant. I could feel it in the moment I was there. I said, this is exactly what I'm looking for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And come to find out, it was only they were going to pull the building down. It's still the building still hasn't been pulled down. Welcome to New York City. That's how it works here. But you know, they said the most we can give you is a 9-month lease. They're waiting for permits from the Department of Buildings. And I said, okay, you know, what would I do if I only had 9 months, right? And part of what is hard about being a chef or a restaurateur is that there's a daily grind to it that you sort of don't know until you're the owner.
Yep.
Meaning like you're a cook, right? So you work maximum a couple years in every restaurant and you sort of bounce around. There's new ideas and new people. And then you get to owning a restaurant. There's no bouncing around, right? This is your child and you have to look after it. And so there's a bit of a grind that can happen there. And you sort of like go through the motions every day. And it's the same issues every day. though exciting, and I feel very lucky and blessed to be able to be in my position, there is a bit of this sort of like, man, I just wish I could break out and do something else, right? And at the time, I had some creative friends that I was around, and I said, well, what if we just did a pop up and I didn't have a
and by the way, that was back when pop ups weren't so ubiquitous.
I didn't have a roadmap for it. I didn't know anyone who'd done it, and I don't know that there was many of this kind.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, what would be the most challenging thing we should do? I have no idea why we decided to do
it. The closest thing
it
would be like Next. I mean, obviously
it
had a different...
It didn't exist yet.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
right.
But it didn't exist
really,
yet.
Most pop-ups are like just, you know, even jankier. Yours was pretty janky.
Yeah.
We agree, but...
On purpose janky. Yeah. Yeah. And it was experiential, and it was on purpose because I didn't want it to be... I didn't want the expectation of something perfect to be there when you walk through the door. I wanted it to feel like what it was.
Which is like walking into a movie without having seen the trailer.
Yeah.
Which is so good.
Yeah. And when your expectation is met and exceeded, it feels a lot better, right?
I mean,
and we were able to do that pretty consistently because the expectation was so low.
And my last question is, you had the idea to do it on what, Kickstarter?
Right. So one of my partners in it, we were talking one day about how we were going to get the money together. I mean, who on earth would invest in a restaurant that was only going to be there for 9 months? I mean, that's possibly...
You're sure to not make any money. Yeah.
Strike one, it's a restaurant. Strike two, it's only going to be there for 9 months. So she was talking about this crowdfunding thing called Kickstarter. And at the time, I don't know that there was a restaurant who had done it. And I didn't even know what Kickstarter was. So she introduced us to it. So we made this little video and we sort of threw it out there and it got such incredible response.
Aww.
And come to find out, even more than that... And so we like wrote the Kickstarter patrons on the wall next to the bathroom. And it was like, but it also was, it not only crowdfunded the cash to help us kick off and build it, but it also gave us a client base.
Absolutely.
Right?
You know,
which
what?
Is maybe the more valuable.
Absolutely. And your future investors and admirers and fans and audience. And, you know, Kickstarter and pop-ups are so crucial to innovation. This is so cool.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah.
So with just a little bit of time left, stay close. After a very brief commercial break, we're going to wind it down.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
You're listening to Word of Mouth on Heritage Radio Network. And with just a couple minutes left, we're going to wind it down.
Wind down.
We have on the line Davis Anderson, sommelier at the Teeny New York Sushi Co. in the Lower East Side. And we're going to empower you to go on a wine shopping spree because it will make you a better adult. Right, Davis?
That is absolutely true, Lacey. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. So... isn't it crazy how much wine we buy at the very last minute on the way to the dinner party? I mean, like, why is all wine consumed between 24 to 48 hours of being purchased?
A lot of people, I don't think, put a lot of forethought into it until, like, that last-minute decision is really just about to hit them in the face. They're like, oh, my God, we're going to this party. We need wine. Or we're having people over. We need wine. So I think it's a really good idea to stock up, not just for people who want to collect or sit on wine, but for anyone who likes to enjoy wine at home in general.
So it's about to be the wintertime. So for our bunker, what should we be looking at?
Well, you're about to have the holidays. You can never have enough wine on hand, whether you're invited to a last-minute party or you last-minute have guests over. It's going to keep happening to you. So I always recommend having a couple bottles on hand. For me, I always like having some bubbly around.
Okay.
This is a very celebratory time of the year. You don't have to go crazy and spend the money that champagne always demands, though I do love champagne. There are great alternatives being made in the U.S. and Germany and Spain. One of my go-tos is a cava producer called Reventus y Blanc, who makes both a beautiful Blanc and a beautiful rosé that are absolutely delicious and won't break your bank at around like $20 to $25 a bottle on most shelves.
Wonderful. And so what else is crucial? A red and a white, right?
I would definitely have some red around, especially as the weather is turning colder. I look to Côte d'Aron usually around this time of year because they're not overpowerful. They have nice bits of spice to them. They have nice bits of fruit to them. They're usually friendly for a lot of different people. There are a lot of bigger producers whose wines you may not be able to afford on their high-end brands, but you can get introduced to them through their Côte d'Aron. People like Gigal or Perrin or Chapoutier or Paulo Tard. So there's a lot of really great values to find in Côte d'Aron. When it comes to whites, I honestly tell people that the places that I look to are still really overlooked in France are Alsace and the Loire. You can find really delicious things coming out of Alsace from people like Zindhumbrecht, whether it's Pinot Blanc or just one of their blends or Gewürztraminer. The wines are incredibly inexpensive, beautiful, bright, fresh, and fruity, and just really friendly. And I've never put a glass in someone's hand and had them go like, oh, no, what was that? Usually the look on their face is, oh, my God, what is this delicious thing you handed me?
So what's how many bottles do you say you usually have on hand in your New York City apartment? Just to like, just to...
I am probably not the world's best example. I will fill a very small apartment with way too much wine. I've been in the process of moving, and a friend is currently house-sitting 7 cases of wine for me. I have 3 in my house right now, and I'm getting ready to move and probably take delivery on 2 more. So I'll probably be sitting on about 12 cases, but over the holiday season, I'm expecting that to go down to 8 or 9 very quickly.
Okay, I'm going shopping. And then what is the bare minimum we need to stock up on for a stormy day?
For me, what I always have on hand at home, I always have a 6-pack of beer in the fridge. I always have a bottle of champagne, and I always, always have a bottle of whiskey. I feel that if you have those 3 things, you're going to be set for any sort of occasion.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, like anything. The end of the world. Thank you so much, Davis.
Leyte, thank you for having me on.
That was just Davis Anderson of New York Sushi Co. on what to stock up before the holiday season. And we had live in-studio chef partner John Fraser of Dovetail in the Upper West Side and Narcisa in the Standard Hotel East Village. And at the top of the show, we also heard from chef and sustainable seafood advocate Carrie Heffernan at the Green Market. We're live 2 p.m. Eastern Wednesdays on Word of Mouth, heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Leyte Su. Next week, we'll have on David Waltuck, chef of the legendary Chanterelle restaurant, which opened in 1979. And we're going to talk his brand new spot, Edlan. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.